Moore and I are pleased and privileged to have sitting with us this morning Judge Ben Bachman, distinguished judge from the Northern District of Indiana, who has previously, and of course again today, has graciously agreed to serve with us. Judge Ben Bachman, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Our first case for argument this morning is the United States versus Equipment Acquisition. Mr. Clark.
May it please the Court, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I could. The issue in this bankruptcy court is whether the trustee can recover a federal tax payment that the debtor corporation had made on behalf of its shareholders as a fraudulent transfer under the state's fraudulent conveyance law. Whether the trustee can do that turns on the interpretation of two provisions of the bankruptcy code. That is Section 106A and Section 544B1. Now, Section 106A waives or abrogates the sovereign immunity of all governmental units with respect to 59 specified sections of the Bankruptcy Code, including the 4 sections of the code that permit the trustee to avoid transfers of the debtor's property. That's Section 544, 547 through 549. Now, it's our view that the waiver in 106A is clearly unequivocal. It clearly waives sovereign immunity with respect to those sections. Now, what does that mean? We think that what that means is that the trustee can maintain a suit under any of those transfer sections, under the avoidance sections, but then you have to go to that section to find out what the elements of the cause of action that the trustee has. So, for example, under the preference section 547, if the trustee were to bring a suit to set aside an avoidance to a non-insider that took place 93 days before the bankruptcy petition, well, that would be subject to dismissal for failure to state a claim because section 547 defines the cause of action as, in part, a transfer to a non-insider that took place within 90 days. Well, we think the same mode of analysis applies with respect to Section 544. Section 544 defines this trustee's cause of action as one where an actual unsecured creditor of the bankruptcy estate can avoid the transfer under an applicable law. So that's the question, whether any unsecured creditor of this bankruptcy estate could recover this federal tax payment under the Illinois State Fraudulent Transfer Statute? And we think the answer is no. I mean, the district court itself said that in its opinion, that no unsecured creditor of this estate could avoid this transfer under the Illinois Fraudulent Transfer Statute. Now, we think that the courts below and the trustee's position here really turns the language of Section 544B on its head. Because the upshot of the lower court's opinions is that the trustee is now able to avoid a transfer that no unsecured creditor of the estate could avoid. So it's permitting the trustee to do precisely what the statute says that a creditor cannot do. Now, and it's our view that turns the statute on its head. Now, the courts below, the bankruptcy and district courts below, as well as several of the other courts that have held against the government on this issue, have criticized the government's position on the ground in part that it would render Section 544 meaningless. It would render meaningless 544's inclusion in 106A. But that clearly is not the case for two completely independent reasons. The first is that we agree that sovereign immunity is waived with respect to any action the trustee might bring under 544A. Now, 544A not only entitles the trustee to avoid transfers, but it gives them all the rights and powers of the hypothetical creditors listed there, judicial lien creditors, bona fide purchasers. So there's more than avoidance of actual transfers. We cite in our brief, Section 2410 is a waiver of sovereign immunity that permits the avoidance of transfers. But there's even more than that because, if the trustee has this status and the rights and powers of a lien creditor or a purchaser, then it might also rely on Section 502 or 506 of the Bankruptcy Code, as to which sovereign immunity is also waived. 502 permits the trustee to object to claims. 506 permits the trustee to determine the secured status of claims. And it can bring those actions against governmental units because of the waiver in Section 106A, which gives him the status, gives the trustee the status of one of those creditors. Now, the second completely independent reason why our position is not rendered meaningless is that, you know, to say our position is meaningless would read Section 106A as applying only to the United States. And that's not so. I mean, the fact of the matter is that the waiver in 106A1 applies to all governmental units. It applies to state, local, and indeed even foreign states. Governmental units is defined in Section 10127. And so as we pointed out in our brief, and the amici have pointed out in their brief, and you know, one of the amici in that brief is the Attorney General of Illinois, you know, Illinois appears to have waived sovereign immunity with respect to fraudulent transfer actions against the state in their own court of claims. Now, the amici brief points out, but not so with respect to state tax payments because they have their voluntary payment doctrine. We didn't point that out. But nevertheless, there are certainly other fraudulent conveyance actions that might be brought. Now, you know, the state has waived sovereign immunity with respect to actions in the state court of claims, but still the trustee needed the waiver in Section 106A1 to bring that same action in the bankruptcy court. It's a waiver that allows the trustee to bring the action in the bankruptcy court, which the trustee could not do absent that waiver. So it really is, we think, incorrect to say that the reference to 544 in 106A1 is rendered meaningless by our position. It's not. It still certainly has meaning. Now, the courts below and several other courts that have ruled against us have also said, in reliance on the Supreme Court's decision in Moore versus Bay, that the trustee's rights under Section 544 are greater than the rights that are given to an unsecured creditor. And again, we believe that to be incorrect. Now, the code did... The legislative history shows that the code intended to incorporate the holding of Moore versus Bay, but it did that explicitly. What Moore versus Bay says is that even though a creditor, in setting aside a fraudulent transfer, his recovery is limited to the amount of that creditor's claim, not so for the trustee in bankruptcy. The trustee is empowered to avoid the transfer, in the words of the statute, to avoid the transfer. And then the remedies are set forth in Section 550. If the trustee can avoid the transfer, then it can set aside the entire transfer and bring the entire value of the property transferred back into the estate. I mean, that's the holding of Moore versus Bay. But the statutory provisions, 544B and 106A1 read together, certainly do not empower the trustee to bring avoidance actions that are greater than those that are granted to a state law creditor. Because indeed, the plain language of Section 540B1 indicates an evident intent to make the trustee's rights coextensive with the rights of a state law creditor. They're not to be greater than a state law creditor. They're the same as a state law creditor. So whatever a state law creditor can do, the trustee can do as well.
But again, as you've noted, every lower court that's had this case in front of it have gone the other way.
Yes, Your Honor. With respect to federal tax payments, right. Now there are some that have adopted our position with respect to state tax payments.
In similar fact situations as you have, they've all gone the opposite direction.
Yes, with respect to federal tax payments, that's correct, Your Honor. This is the first time the issue has been squarely presented before a court of appeals. We pointed out in our brief the Fourth Circuit has some dicta where it made the statement that sovereign immunity is waived. But again, it's an unpublished decision, and there's no indication that the court really considered the argument or considered the issue. So that's why I say that this is really a case of first impression in the courts of appeals. Now, we would also add, as we've argued all along, that Section 106A5 of the Bankruptcy Code simply reinforces our position that the trustee cannot stand in the shoes of a state law creditor and bring a fraudulent conveyance action to recover a federal tax payment. 106A5 says that nothing in 106A is to be construed as creating a cause of action that does not exist under the bankruptcy code, the bankruptcy rules, or under applicable law. Well, the other courts below and the trustee argues, well, you know, they're not creating a new cause of action because the fraudulent transfer actions do exist under applicable law. But under that interpretation of 106A5, that would render that provision, I think, meaningless.
Well, Mr. Clark, we agree with you about 544B. We don't need to reach that, do we?
If you agree about 544B, no, that's not necessary to reach that question. That's correct, Your Honor. So, you know, in sum, you know, I think that all that 106A does in waiving sovereign immunity with respect to those sections is that, you know, it says nothing about what the trustee must prove under the other avoidance sections to maintain a cause of action. If there are no further questions, I'll have to take my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Mr. Apostolides.
May it please the Court. Good morning. My name is George Apostolides, and I'm here on behalf of Equipment Acquisition Resources by William A. Brandt, the plan administrator for Equipment Acquisition Resources. This Court should affirm both the District Court and the Bankruptcy Court and find that sovereign immunity does not bar a judgment for EAR, Equipment Acquisition Resources, in the amount of $871,608 as entered by the Bankruptcy Court and affirmed by the District Court for four reasons. First, Congress's intent to abrogate sovereign immunity completely and totally as a defense to Section 544 claims is clear and unequivocal from the plain language of Section 106, Section 544 of the Bankruptcy Code. Second, the abrogation of sovereign immunity as to 544 claims in Section 106A1 does not create a substantive claim for relief under 544, contrary to 106B5, as the government has argued. Third, the provisions of the Internal Revenue Code do not provide this Court with any basis for reversal of the lower courts. And finally, the reasons given by the states in their amicus brief also are not valid reasons for reversal. In sum, the courts below properly interpreted the interplay between Section 544, Section 106A1, and Section 106A5, and used the canons of statutory interpretation properly and appropriately in finding that sovereign immunity had been abrogated as to 544 claims. First, Congress's intent to abrogate sovereign immunity is complete and total with respect to 544 claims, and the statutory language makes that absolutely positively clear. Section 106A1 says sovereign immunity is abrogated as to a governmental unit to the extent set forth in this section with respect to the following, and Section 544 is listed along with 58 other provisions. To abrogate, as noted by the District Court, means to abolish, to appeal, in effect to get rid of completely and entirely. The United States should not be able to assert sovereign immunity at any point in this litigation because it has been abrogated by 106A1. Sovereign immunity, of course, is a government's immunity from being sued in its own courts. So the United States Congress, by including Section 544 in 106A1, knew that it was opening itself up to be sued for the recovery of federal tax payments. And in fact, the history of 106A1 makes that very clear. 106A1 was amended in 1994 as an override, a legislative override, to a Supreme Court decision called United States versus Nordic Village, 503 U.S. 30, 1992. In Nordic Village, the court held that a prior version of 106A1 did not allow a money judgment against the United States. Congress looked at that and said, you know, the United States shouldn't have sovereign immunity and should not be able to be the recipient of a fraudulent transfer. Just because the United States is the government does not mean that it shouldn't be sued in the event that it's received a transfer that's fraudulent, just like any other recipient of a fraudulent transfer in a bankruptcy. And for that reason, the abrogation occurred. Now, in 1994, when Congress amended that statute, it knew that Section 544 allowed bankruptcy trustees to use state law to avoid and recover fraudulent transfers.
Well, what would you say is the clear indication of that other than the text? I mean, congressional intent.
Well,
I mean, I agree that the 94 Act was in response to Nordic and Hoffman.
the text, you know, the canons of statutory interpretation tell the court they should follow the plain language of the text to discern the legislature's intent. And the plain language of the text here is that Section 544, our claims under Section 544 are claims for which sovereign immunity has been abrogated. Now, the government argues that there's a difference between 544A claims and 544B claims. But if that were the case, Congress would have said that, and Congress didn't say that. Congress abrogated sovereign immunity to all 544 claims, and to read the statute otherwise would be to be reading something that's not there, and that's not what this court should be doing. And in fact, that's not what any court that's considered this issue has done. As noted,
we don't get any help from legislative history, though, do we?
No, there's not any help from legislative history. Now, the government takes the position that because there's no legislative that there should have been legislative history because this was a sea change in the law. But the fact is that Congress, is, as the government acknowledges, was responding to Nordic Village and included 544 in the total abrogation in 106A1. Contrary to what the government has argued, the United States has consented to be sued for the avoidance and recovery of fraudulent transfers under state fraudulent transfer law. That's exactly what Congress did. Government has argued at numerous points in its brief that the government has not consented to be sued, but yes, it did, and that's what the statute says. Second, the abrogation in Section 106A1 does not create a substantive claim for relief under 544 in violation of 106A5, as the government has argued, for three reasons. First, under Section 544, bankruptcy trustees have broader rights than unsecured creditors do. A trustee can avoid an entire transfer under Section 544 when in the shoes of a creditor. If there were a debtor and a creditor was suing that debtor for fraudulent transfer in state court, that debtor, that creditor could only recover the amount of its credit, the amount that the debtor owed to it. That is not the case under 544. Under 544, if there is a creditor, any creditor, a bankruptcy trustee can file a lawsuit and recover the entire amount of the transfer from the debtor, regardless of what the amount of the creditor's claim is. So Section 544 is broader than just the trustee stepping in the shoes of a state law creditor. As the government noted in its opening argument, this was the rule in Moore versus Bay, Supreme Court case from 1931, and it's clear that the rule from Moore versus Bay was retained in the amendments to this statute. This is consistent, once again, with the Bankruptcy Code's goal of benefiting all of the creditors of a bankruptcy estate. The second reason is the IRS's interpretation of Section 544B would render the inclusion of 544 in 106A1 absolutely meaningless. It's clear that no state could abrogate the sovereign immunity of the United States in a state statute. Congress knew that when it included 544 in Section 106A1. Congress could have excluded 544 claims from 106A1, but it didn't. The United States tries to draw a distinction between 544 claims and 547, 548, and 549 claims. But that begs the question, if there's that distinction, why did Congress include 544 in the statute in the first place? If Congress didn't want claims under 544 to be brought against the government, it should have kept that provision out of 106A1. It didn't. The third reason is that 106A1 does not create any substantive claims that don't already exist. Bankruptcy trustees have been utilizing state fraudulent transfer laws to avoid transfers for a very long time. They did so under 544. They did so under the predecessor law, Section 70E of the Bankruptcy Act. The fact is that there is no substantive claim that has been created by the inclusion of 544 in 106A1, and 106A5 does not change that. Another way to think about this, if there's any question in your honor's minds, is that sovereign immunity is a defense. It's not a substantive claim. If the United States is sued by a creditor, it has the defense of sovereign immunity. There is no cause of action for sovereign immunity that can be brought. Under 106A5, there cannot be any new substantive claims created by the abrogation of sovereign immunity in 106A1, and there aren't. In addition, that the government raised an argument regarding the Court of Claims and says that a bankruptcy trustee could potentially sue the United States. I think that it argued that a bankruptcy trustee could sue the United States under Illinois state fraudulent transfer law in the Illinois court or in the Court of Claims. That's completely irrelevant to what we're talking about here. This transfer and the lawsuit seeking to avoid and recover this transfer are under federal bankruptcy law. Whether or not there could be a lawsuit against the state of Illinois in the Court of Claims has nothing to do with whether a bankruptcy trustee can sue the United States in the bankruptcy court. Third, the provisions of the Internal Revenue Code are not a basis for reversal. Though the government didn't argue it in its opening argument, the IRS has taken the position in this case that federal tax law preempts all claims for the recovery of tax payments in their entirety. The court should reject that for three reasons. First, preemption is a brand new argument raised in this court. It was not raised in the bankruptcy court. It was not raised in the district court. The bankruptcy court opinion doesn't touch it. The district court opinion doesn't touch it. And the reason that neither of those courts addressed it is it was not raised. It is patently clear that a party's failure to raise arguments in the courts below waives them on appeal. And the United States has, in this case, waived preemption as an argument. The United States argues in its brief that the argument was implicit in the briefing below. But I don't think we should have to guess as to what the United States arguments are. The fact is that there are two sections of the Internal Revenue Code which were raised below in connection with jurisdiction. It had nothing to do with preemption. Second, the settlement agreement which governed this case limited the United States to its second defense. The United States, we settled with the United States. We settled all the 548 claims, and we received a payment on those. The United States reserved this second defense only with regard to the 544 claim. The second defense, which is quoted in our brief, deals only with sovereign immunity. It does not mention preemption at all. The fact is that the United States limited itself in the settlement agreement. It did that for its reasons. There's no criticism of that. But the fact is that it didn't preserve the defense for this case, and so it's not part of this case. And last, even if the court decides to consider preemption, and it shouldn't, but even if you do, there's no basis for reversing the lower courts. There's no section of the Internal Revenue Code that was cited by the United States for the proposition that all federal tax payments are subject to the Internal Revenue Code as opposed to bankruptcy avoidance actions like this one. The fact is there is a long history of lawsuits against the United States for the recovery of fraudulent transfer payments. Those cases are cited in our brief, and they're before this court. Finally, the arguments raised in the amicus brief by the states are no basis for reversal whatsoever. The amici are interested in this dispute because, and I quote, the rulings below jeopardized a substantial source of revenue for state taxing authorities. But this is not a lawsuit against a state. This is a lawsuit against the federal government. Whether the states may have some additional defenses to a fraudulent transfer claim that my client has brought is a question for another day. It's not a question for now. There's nothing that the states have raised other than, you know, they've made duplicative arguments of the federal government in the first instance, but the fact that they may have an interest in this because suits like this could jeopardize state tax payments has nothing to do with the suit before you today. If you don't have any other questions, I'll sit.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Clark.
Well, first, we believe that the preemption argument we made on brief is fairly encompassed within the terms of the settlement agreement. Although the settlement agreement and its label said we're reserving the sovereign immunity defense, if you look at the terms of the agreement, which is in the appellate's appendix, and specifically paragraph 9, which is at page 29 of the appendix, in the paragraph it says it is understood that the dispositive motion that the government will file will include a contention that an ordinary creditor could not sue to recover this federal tax payment. And we didn't limit it to any specific arguments, but we said we're going to make the general argument that no unsecured creditor
could sue. You didn't use the word preemption, though.
Well, we did not use the word preemption. That's granted, Your Honor. No question, we did not use the word preemption.
And to some extent, you sort of kind of hint all around it without saying it.
Well, again, I think it's fairly encompassed by saying that, you know, we're going to be arguing in our dispositive motion that no unsecured creditor could recover this payment. And we didn't limit the reasons. But yes, in the label it says sovereign immunity, but we think that the argument is fairly encompassed there. Okay. Now, counsel says that the fact that Illinois might have waived sovereign immunity with respect to fraudulent conveyance actions in state courts is irrelevant here, but it's not irrelevant. I mean, the reason that it's relevant is that the trustee and the courts below have long argued that our position renders the reference to 544B in 106A irrelevant. And it doesn't. It still has meaning because it still would apply to that situation. So, and that's the point, and that's why it is relevant, because, under our position, Section 544B still has some meaning with respect to the waiver in 106A. Now, what this may come down to in the end is what does the language with respect to in 106A1 mean? We're both in agreement here, and there's no question about it, that 106A1 meets the unequivocal waiver standard that the Supreme Court has long espoused. But still, there might be a question about this. There could be a question about the scope of that waiver. What does with respect to mean? And, the Court has long held that if there are two plausible interpretations of the statute, one which waives sovereign immunity and one which does not waive sovereign immunity, the courts are constrained to go with the interpretation that does not waive sovereign immunity. That's what the court held in Nordic Village, and that's what the court held just last year in FAA versus Cooper, which is cited in the amicus brief. So for the government to prevail here, we don't have to convince you that the trustee's interpretation of this statute is implausible. All I have to do is convince you that our interpretation is plausible.
It's good to be the government.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
It's good to be the government.
Well, when you have statements like FAA, Cooper, and Nordic Village like that, that is helpful.
I understand.
So the bottom line here, there's nothing in the with respect to language in 106A1 that reads the limitation of 544B out of the statute. It is still there, and we think that the holdings below are wrong, because they're turning the statutory language on its head by allowing the trustee to do precisely what a creditor cannot do. And that's just contrary to the language of 544B. And no further questions, I'll
ask. Thank you, Mr. Clark, Mr. Vasilides. Thank you both. And the case is taken under advisement.